Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Agriculture in Brazil has the upper hand. They have a lot of influence on both sides.
Greg Dowd is former chief ag negotiator with the U.S. Trade Representative.
What I think you've seen in Brazil as a result of this uncertainty and the lack of enforcement of whatever laws they have down there on the frontier is that it's been the Wild West, and there's been a lot of effort to open up additional farmland on the frontier in Brazil. And so the question is, once that is settled down and they know more who's going to be in charge going forward, is there a clamp down on that? I think that's the question. So when you have this type of uncertainty, that frees folks up to just kind of go crazy in that part of the world. And we've certainly seen that based upon the intelligence that I've seen.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It is very difficult to forecast inflation now. And one of the reasons is just that the situation is so different from the normal one. And as I mentioned, a lot of it's just that the difficulty is just these supply side constraints that we've had. We had no experience in forecasting that. It was, you know, this was a case of first impression. So that was very difficult.
Jerome Powell is chairman of the Federal Reserve. He was speaking recently at an event at the Brookings Institute. Says inflation hard to predict.
Nonetheless, we do make forecasts. We'll continue to make forecasts. The way I tried to get around that in my remarks was to say, let's put the forecasts aside for a second and let's try to identify the macroeconomic conditions that we think we need to see that would put downward pressure on inflation. So that's a way to think about it. We'll continue to make forecasts, but we're going to have to be humble and skeptical about forecasts, I think, for some time. And that calls for a lot of risk management. And the other difficulty, of course, is that monetary policy works with long and variable lags, and particularly inflation is at the end of that train. And so if you're waiting for actual evidence that inflation is coming down, it's very difficult not to over-tighten if that's all you're doing. So we have a risk management balance to strike, and we think that slowing down at this point is a good way to balance the risks on the pace of rate hikes.
If you want to know whether you're speeding in a car, you look at the speedometer. How will the Fed know when to relax?
We're in an ample reserve regime, and what that means is that changes in the reserve level will generally not affect the federal funds rate. So there's more than enough reserves in the system. So we're not close to reserve scarcity. So what we've said is that we would allow reserves to decline until we're somewhat above the level that we think is consistent with an ample with scarcity.
Right.
And then for a while, what you do is you hold the balance sheet constant, and non-reserve liabilities grow while reserves shrink. So we'd sort of shrink gradually down to that. And then at a certain point, we're just going to call it. We're not looking to really go back into proving that they're scarce, because what happens is, and you saw this back a few years, the demand for reserves is not stable, and it can move up and down very substantially. So we want to stop at a place that's safe. You know, having a lot of reserves in the system is really a good thing. It's really a public benefit to have plenty of reserves, plenty of liquidity in the markets and in the banking system and the financial system generally. So that's how we would do it.
But there are times that many of us would look back and want to change something. What would Powell change?
I will say, though, that aside from the framework itself, we implemented it through guidance of various kinds. And we put in really strong guidance because there were a lot of doubters that we would ever achieve 2% inflation, if you remember. That was the main criticism. Little did we know. One piece of guidance that we gave was, and I don't think this had anything to do with or much to do, let's say it that way, it didn't have much to do with all this inflation we're experiencing, but the one piece of guidance that we gave that I probably wouldn't do again is we said we wouldn't lift off until we saw both maximum employment and price stability. And I don't think I would do that again. I think it limited it's the tail risk. We tend as human beings to underestimate tail risk, and I think we didn't think. It seemed so unlikely. If you remember, 25 years of low inflation and many years after the pandemic, after the global financial crisis of inflation everywhere in the world, it's all disinflation, just didn't seem likely. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The information I'm going to share here is an early look at the meat demand monitor.
Dr. Glenn Tonser, livestock economist, Kansas State University.
The listeners here probably know that's a project based at K-State. It's beef and pork checkoff funded. This is an ongoing national survey, and it allows us to speak to domestic meat demand, and I'm going to share the beef demand number specifically, but separately for retail grocery store from food service. And the general story is, you know, there's continued weakness that is building. When we look at grocery store retail demand in November, meat demand was down versus October, and unfortunately also lower than it was a year earlier in November of 2021. When we flip that over to food service demand, and specifically for demand for meals when you're out for dinner away from home, demand in November was up a little bit from October, but specific to the beef and pork meals we look at, so ribeye steak, a hamburger-based, you know, entree meal, pork chop-based meal, and the baby back ribs, or the two beef, two pork we're looking at, those demand metrics are also down from the year earlier. So overall, we continue to see just consumers kind of tightening their financial belt. Inflation, while it is coming down a little bit from the latest read estimates that we're getting, is still above wage growth. So the average resident in the U.S. is falling behind financially, and we're seeing that hit the meat category.
Are we losing meat consumption or just moving it?
Lunch and dinner, the percentage that said they had their, you know, those meals at home in November was up from October. And I do think it's exactly that is, you know, all else equal, the cost of that meal at home tends to be lower than it is away from home. The main reason for that is you're providing free labor is what's underneath that, right? When you prepare your own meal and do your own dishes, when we go out to eat, effectively part of that meal price is paying somebody else to do that. So the service charge. And, you know, historically when finances get tight, we tend to see people eat out less. And we're seeing that show up in different ways here in November.
Is it a blip on the radar or maybe a longer term trend?
I am anticipating it for the next several months, and it's reinforced by some, I call them sentiment questions. So again, in this survey based effort, and it's a large data set that I'm pulling information from, our listeners here probably have heard of the Consumer Sentiment Index. A lot of people reference it. It's been going on for, I think, over 50 years now at the University of Michigan. It's a totally separate large survey that I'm not pulling information from that, but I've used a couple of the same questions in this meat demand focused effort. And I'm trying to work my way towards letting people know sentiment is pretty poor. So the average resident is fairly pessimistic financially. Specifically here in November of this year, 40% indicate they're doing worse, financially speaking, than they did a year ago. When I asked that same question back in November of 21, 31% said they're doing worse. So we've had a notable increase in the percentage of the population that says they're doing worse financially. So those are examples of looking back. Now looking forward in the upcoming year, people are also more pessimistic than they were a year ago. So I think the reality is wages aren't keeping up with inflation and other related things like the stock market. While it's done better in the last 6-8 weeks, it's still down for the year and so forth. So some wealth effects are probably embedded in that sentiment. And anytime, you know, you ask an economist if consumers are financially concerned, they're probably going to tighten their budget, I guess, what we're seeing.
Tightening the belt may not mean eliminating.
Meat is a very broad comment, and we usually do beef, pork, and chicken separate, and then you do steak versus ground and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of different cuts out there. One can think about, right, trading from steak to ground, or maybe from a pork chop to ham and so on and so forth, depending on what prices you're seeing at different times. Or bacon down to a pork chop even on a dollar per pound basis. So you can keep those meat proteins in your diet, but maybe a different cut. But there's also a quality grade component. So, you know, maybe we have some folks trade from prime to choice or choice to select in the beef space where we have a grading. Some are actually finding that buying a smaller package size. So instead of buying 16 ounces of bacon, we're buying 12 ounces. The good news is general interest in protein in the diet is actually pretty strong.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We've got 10 times that amount of money that's already been appropriated or budgeted for the agencies. And I'm very concerned that we're going to flash forward a couple of years. The $800 billion is going to be gone, and we're still going to have a significant portion of the digital divide that we didn't close.
That's a lot of money, says FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr on bridging the digital divide.
Over a year ago now, I think a year and a half ago at this point, July of 2021, I sent letters to all the agencies that you mentioned that have funds, Treasury, Agriculture, Education, Commerce, and I just asked a couple basic questions. You know, one, you know, how are you distributing these funds? What, you know, maps or other data are you using to distribute the funds? You know, are we fully coordinated? Half of them never responded. And that includes significant numbers of follow-up, you know, emails. Hey, just making sure you got this email. No response, or yeah, let's talk. You know, schedule a date and say, hey, we got to reschedule it. So I call it getting hit up with the okie doke. Yeah, yeah, okay, we'll meet, we'll talk. And so that gives me a little bit of pause. And then the answers that I did get didn't really give me a lot of comfort either. You know, I don't think we're using a single map, which we at the FCC should get done the maps. We can drive all these funding decisions through that.
So with all this money, how do we bridge the digital divide?
You know, I think number one is, on the policy perspective, apart from the coordination challenge I think we still have, one, we have to prioritize unserved. And these are communities that have 0 megabits per second over 0 megabits per second. There's still too many of them in this country. And I understand the desire to get everybody to gigabit speeds. I understand the desire to get, you know, multiple choices for your broadband dollars. But we have to elevate and prioritize those communities that are truly on the wrong side of the digital divide. We've got to prioritize there. I don't think we're doing that across a lot of measures, in part because we're defining lack of service as potentially places that have, you know, almost 80 over 20, and we're treating them the same from a prioritization mechanism as those with 0 over 0. That makes no sense in my mind. So I think we've got to prioritize unserved. We've got to get the maps done. You know, we got to continue to grow our workforce to get these builds done. We've got a shortage on the tower climber side. We've got a shortage on, you know, fiber splicers. We've got a shortage across the board. I've been working to try to address that, you know, ones and twos here, standing up community college programs to grow our tower workforce in particular. And we need some infrastructure reform as well. Because if we're just pouring $800 billion out there without further streamlining, we're basically just jumping on the gas and the brakes at the same time. We want these dollars to actually go into the ground, connecting communities. So I think there's a lot we can do from, you know, unserved, better maps, expanding workforce, infrastructure, and also supply chain. You know, we have issues, obviously, across the economy with supply chain right now.
Okay.
As you put this money into the economy, it is going to take up a lot of the resources that are going to be necessary to complete these builds.
With so much money and so many hands of the federal government in the kitty, how do we manage it?
We see it across the board. We see it with DOD, obviously, with Legato and other instances. And at the end of the day, Congress made a decision. They said the FCC, a couple letters there. I know, it's hard. It's hard, this new world we're in. You know, the FCC is the nation's spectrum regulator. You can feed your views into it, get your studies into it. The FCC is going to listen to all stakeholders, and we're going to make the decision that's in the public interest. And so I saw, you know, recently the DOT made some more comments about not knowing that everything is going to be completely copacetic by this next deadline we have for the C-band. And from my view, you know, that's unacceptable. If there's any changes that should be made with respect to the regulatory framework of the FCC licensees with respect to their build-out pursuant to the FCC's regime, it should be made by the FCC.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index was unchanged this month versus last month at a reading of 102. That was, though, 12% lower than it was in November 2021. The index of current conditions was down 3 points versus last month, but that leaves that index 23% lower than it was a year ago. The future expectations index was actually up 2 points this month compared to a month ago, but that leaves that index 5% below where it was in November of 2021. The Farm Financial Performance Index rose 5 points this month compared to a month earlier, 14% lower than November 2021, as that index continues to suggest there is some stress out there. We continue to ask producers what their biggest concerns are for their farming operation in the upcoming year. 42% of the producers in this month's survey chose higher input costs as their top concern, followed by rising interest rates, chosen by 21% of the producers in the survey, and availability of inputs and lower crop or livestock prices, chosen by 14% of the producers in this month's survey. The Farm Capital Investment Index fell 7 points this month to a reading of 31. That's down from 38 last month, and puts it in a tie with its all-time low established a couple of months ago at that reading of 31. That's 21% lower than it was in November of 2021, and it's 67% below the level it achieved in late 2020, early 2021. When we followed up and asked producers who said now is a bad time to make large investments in their farming operation why they felt that way, the top choice continues to be the increase in prices for farm machinery and new construction. The short-term farmland value index was down 4 points this month compared to last month. The long-term index, which asks people to look at what they think is going to happen with respect to farmland values over the next 5 years, was unchanged compared to last month. And that leaves that long-term index down about 9% compared to a year earlier. Once again, we followed up and asked producers who said they expect to see farmland values rise over the next 5 years what the main reason for that expectation was. And the number one choice, again, continues to be non-farm investor demand, this month chosen by 52% of the respondents in the survey, followed by inflation at 26%.
So we move from sentiment among farmers to sentiment from export partners.
U.S. government leaders are negotiating with Mexico regarding an upcoming ban on biotech crops. Dave Salmonson, American Farm Bureau Federation Senior Government Affairs Director, says the issue stems from a 2020 presidential decree from Mexico,
stating their intention to phase out the use of glyphosate, biotechnology, and genetically modified corn by January of 2024. This decree was meant to cover both the use in Mexico of biotechnology and also products produced with biotechnology that are imported.
Salmonson says the top concern is what the decree means for U.S. exports.
Mexico is such a large market for U.S., especially corn, but all kinds of products, so that would have a severely hampering effect, of course, for our exporters, but of course for also Mexico, people using corn. There's really not a lot of other places they could source product. And Mexico has also not approved any new biotechnology traits since 2018.
He says negotiations with Mexico regarding the issue are ongoing.
Secretary Vilsack met with the Mexican President Obrador. Mexican government has been signaling recently they were maybe open to some more discussion about this. Also this week, our trade representative will be meeting with the Mexican economy minister. American Farm Bureau, other ag groups have weighed in on this with letters and meetings. And of course, ultimately, necessary, a case could be brought under the dispute settlement provisions of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement.
Michael Clements, Washington.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One-third of the population nationally says they intentionally include protein in their diet to help meet their personal fitness goals, whether that's jogging or muscle strengthening exercises.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonser.
And that particular comment is extra relevant for millennials. So nearly half of millennials, and for quick reference, millennials are those born between 1981 and 1996. They're more likely, you know, one in two basically, say they eat protein for that reason. And conversely, baby boomers are much less likely. Only about 16% of baby boomers say they eat protein for that reason intentionally. The reason I'm highlighting that is the millennial group is a large group. Their buying power continues to grow, and they're going to be here for the, you know, foreseeable future as customers. And hopefully that gives some staying power to various components of these adjustments you're asking me about.
Now, protein could be defined in a lot of different ways.
The question is asked broader, right, for protein to capture all those. So I don't want to mislead people. They could be eating protein that is beef, pork, chicken, salmon, you know, even plant-based patty. Those would all be included in that as protein sources. But in the same effort, we also ask all these folks what you had yesterday. So they're called prior day recall questions, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Did you have it at home or away from home? And then which of those proteins did you include? And certainly chicken, beef, and pork are the three primary proteins that people say they had yesterday. And that matches up with USDA estimates of consumption and so forth. So in general, I definitely think it is the meat proteins that are those millennials I'm talking about are referring to. But I want to be clear for your listeners, they could also be getting protein as well from, you know, seafood, plant-based, and other items that aren't meat livestock items.
But to actually reach today's millennial, what do you have to have?
You know, do you have a product that's convenient, easy to eat on the go, ready to eat? Those kind of things are pretty important for a busy, you know, the typical millennial is all our listeners are busy, so I don't want to mislead, but millennials are more likely to have children at home, so they're juggling other things, not just their own schedule, but their kids' schedule and so forth. So the value of convenience tends to be higher. You know, giving advice to, in this case, probably the beef and the pork industry, I think elevated importance on convenience and ease of consuming your products is even more important with the millennial generation than, say, the baby boomers.
Obviously, there's a large focus on domestic demand, but what about export demand?
The third leg of that, you know, demand stool is foreign. So every beef and pork product we produce in the U.S. is either consumed here domestically through grocery store or away from home. So those are the two domestic channels, or the third leg of that three-legged stool is foreign demand. We export it. And both the beef and pork industry have been very successful in the last 10 years. They're growing those markets. And, you know, I'm optimistic that'll continue for the next 10 years, and that will be part of that quote-unquote replacement.
I guess maybe in closing, Glenn, what do you see for maybe the week ahead or even the month ahead?
Yeah, so there's a lot of discussion and interest in the January cattle inventory report, where we're at with the number of cows that have been liquidated, what USDA says that is versus the weekly slaughter numbers and so forth. We're not going to get to update that here within December, but I am going to start alluding to that because we're less than 2 months from that. There's going to be a lot of interest in that. You know, we have the Thanksgiving holiday now in the rearview mirror. We're upcoming on the Christmas one. I think there's going to be a lot of interest on exactly what consumers do. You know, the wholesale buying of meat getting ready for Christmas is well in play, but exactly how many people pay up for, you know, a prime rib at Christmas, how many try to make, you know, their Christmas meal and or their New Year's celebration a little more economical are going to be some things we really watch the next few weeks ahead. I'm cautiously optimistic. There's a jobs report that came out that actually unemployment is not rising. At face value, that is good.
And at the end of the day, he says those low unemployment numbers could help extend a rally for quite some time. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Back in the year 2000,
Kevin Brinkley is CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association, PCCA.
For the younger listeners, that probably doesn't ring too many bells, but for those of us that have a few miles, you remember that the dot-com era was flying high about then, and of course everybody wanted to put everything on the internet. But luckily, PCCA had had the Telcod system since 1975, and it was kind of a natural move for PCCA to join up with some of the other big firms in the cotton sector, and the seam was put together back in 2000, and is thriving to this day as a very well-known agritech company. And so they not only do cotton marketing, online cotton marketing, but they do a lot of technology for other commodities such as peanuts. And one thing that people may not know is that the seam is the technology behind the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol. And so dealing with producers' sustainability data and keeping that all very private and very secure is what they're doing at the moment.
He also talks about the marketing options available through the cooperative.
We want to have something that we can offer for every grower to, you know, sell his cotton the way he wants to sell it, when he wants to sell it. So we wanted to have a really good marketing experience. And so for producers that, you know, given the weather conditions we've got right now, I think we'll have a lot of them that will actually just kind of see what they produce. And with prices being where they are, they'll probably go toward the cash market. And so that looks like either the seam, which the PCCA is the exclusive provider of the seam in this area, and the seam offers a producer the ability to simultaneously offer his cotton out to dozens and dozens of all the major and even the small cotton buyers here in the U.S. and abroad. So he can essentially kind of conduct an auction for his cotton, if you want to look at it that way. But we also, we're very active in cash trading for producers that want to have a bit more hands-on, and we have a thing called PCCA Direct where we can kind of help them position their cotton in the right way and get them custom pricing on that. For producers that are you know, have pretty good irrigation and have you know, a pretty good conviction that they can raise a crop, we offer some contract options for them. Certainly the prices are at really good levels right now, but the production outlook is kind of iffy. We only do bale contracts here at PCCA. The reason for that, you would have to, again, just look out your window and know that conditions are dry. And so our bale contracts are something, though, that we have very competitive levels on those. And then lastly, the pool is designed for for those that want to have PCCA do the marketing for them, and that is an acre commitment. So the beauty of that is that you're not committed to a certain number of bales. You just deliver the production off those acres, and then we market that cotton, all that cotton together across the year, and look for the best opportunities to do that. And then we pay an average return out to all the growers that are involved in the pool. So those are kind of the three options that are available out there in general terms. But our staff would love to talk to anybody about what it is that meets their need.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think it's going to be a challenge for us in certain parts of the world where per capita incomes are kind of below that middle income threshold. And then you combine that with the fact that I think Brazil is just going to be absolutely, busting the bins down there here as we get into the middle of next year.
Greg Dowd, former chief ag trade negotiator.
We need some water in the Mississippi River somewhere along the way as well here. So I think the combination of these factors just means that 2022, we're probably going to have another record in terms of U.S. ag exports, but 2023 is we're going to have some very, very serious headwinds, both in terms of demand destruction in the world, supplies from competitors, and the strength and the value of the dollar.